Good afternoon. My name is Niran Saraf, and I'm an Iraqi American. I was born in Iraq, and I've been in the United States for the last 15 years or so. Today I'm going to be talking about Iraqi women, the status of Iraqi women in the 50s and the 60s and during the Saddam era and also post Saddam era in the last since 2003 and where they are today. What is the current political situation in Iraq today and how is it affecting Iraqi women? And what is the future or the near future for Iraqi women? And then finally, what are Iraqi women trying to do, whether inside Iraq or outside Iraq, in order to guarantee that any future Iraq at least guarantees them some kind of equal rights or women's rights or human rights, if you like. Just a caveat, since I know there's a press in here, I'm not a political scientist. I am a computer scientist. So my observation is as a woman who's worked hard on trying to get equal rights for women, whether here in the United States or in Iraq or even when I was growing up, and both in the engineering and the professional world, and also trying to encourage a young generation of women who are in high schools and moving to universities to try and teach them what to expect in their professional life and how can they continue the movement forward as their responsibility to maximize and ensure that whatever the previous generation did for women's rights, that it continues in the future. So this is all, it's not based on any, if you like, academic political science, but I think it is important because I bring an observation from both the, as a person who's an Iraqi and who's worked and lived in the U.S., and also I had the opportunity to live 8 years in Europe, so I kind of have the gamut of the different cultures and the different approaches to women's rights and women's education in different countries. And Iraq in the 50s and 60s and before the Ba'ath regime in Iraq, women really enjoyed, if you like, equal rights and as far as you know, what your family could afford. So if your family could afford to send you to an education and you had the opportunity to go to college and you worked and you lived with what used to be the social norm for a woman, i.e. you went and you had your education, you worked, and but you had to get married and also take care of your children at home. So there wasn't what we call, you know, it wasn't like in Saudi Arabia where women were not allowed to go to school. It wasn't a segregated environment. Women, we had country clubs, just like the British had country clubs. So women, if you could afford to go to a country club, women would go to a country club, and they'd wear their regular swimming suit and tennis attire, and women would bike and walk in the street. And it was up to you to wear the, really it was not the hijab per se, as far as the today it's viewed in you know, in the veil, but it's more like a dress. It's a national dress. You know, women in villages and countryside in Iraq covered themselves in the black, what we call abaya. We don't even call it the, you know, the veil. But at the same time, she rolled up her sleeve and pulled up her clothes because she was working in the farm and she, you know, she didn't want to. So it wasn't, it was a national dress. That's how they dressed up. Of course, there were other, if you like, religious areas such as Najaf and Karbala where the dress was a little bit much more conservative because of the nature of the place, which is more of a religious place. And Iraq was a very secular country in that we had, when I grew up, I used to tell people we celebrated all the different religions. You know, we had, my brother went to a Jewish school, my sisters went to a convent school run by the French. So, you know, and every morning, you know, if you were up to you whether you did the Christian prayers or not. So, you know, we had the Armenian Christmas, and we had the Iranian, and the Nowruz, and the Kurdish New Year. So we were lucky. We had a lot of days off during that time in Iraq. And then the Ba'ath regime came along, and things were, you know, kind of continued. Everyone suffered in Iraq, not just women suffered in Iraq. But then in 1959, the personal status law in Iraq was very, very good towards women in that it tried to give it a lot of equal rights, if you like, when it comes to inheritance and it comes to, you know, divorce and custody of kids and all that. And then Saddam in the 79 when he came to power, he used women. He used women in order to look liberal towards the West. And the statistics for women going into enrollment, I mean, he's a butcher, he did horrible things, and I'm not saying that I'm a fan of Saddam, don't misunderstand. However, he did use women and up to 1990, and the number of women who went into education, who went into engineering, there was no discrimination per se. There was no concept of glass ceiling. You had the same amount, you know, if you were good and if you studied hard, you had the same opportunity to study medicine, engineering, anything you wanted. There was no obstacle for you per se as a woman. During the Iraq-Iran war, there were a lot of men who went to war, so we needed women to go and fill in the gaps in employment. A lot of women in the public infrastructure were having a huge positions, high positions, running ministries sometimes even. They were not maybe within the government or the parliament, you know, good for them, but they were actually running the whole public infrastructure in Iraq. And of course, but at the same time, they were expected to do the work at home. So, you know, you have your professional life, but you also have your duties and responsibilities at work. As far as the social infrastructure was concerned, you lived within, if you like, you know, maybe what it was 30, 40 years here in the U.S., where you had, you know, you were allowed to date, but you know, premarital sex, you know, which was fine. We didn't have honor killing per se like you have in Jordan. You know, so if you got pregnant before marriage, you either get married and save your life, or you try to get back alley abortion or miscarriage, or, you know, disappear somewhere, you know, but oftentimes it ended up that, so there is no sexual liberation, but that didn't only apply to women, that also applied to men. You know, you didn't leave your parents' house, whether you're a man or a woman, until you got married. So these are social things that existed in Iraq. Then the 90s came along, and the 90s were really horrendous for Iraq, for the Iraqis, so the whole infrastructure in Iraq, because of the sanctions. A lot of people were working within the government in Iraq, and you couldn't survive. You know, the government salary hardly was enough for you to just to cover your transportation to go to work. You had no option not to go to work, so you were stuck. So ultimately, the whole social infrastructure in Iraq got broken down because of the 90s. And Saddam used Islam because he needed, all of a sudden the West was not sexy for him, so he had to go to the Islam route. So he used the Islamic card in order to get the neighboring countries to support him, in order to get whoever he wanted to support. So as a result of that, there was a lot of the things that he outlawed in the 80s, he brought back. So you can have, men can marry more than one woman. All of a sudden, women lost their rights in divorce. All of a sudden, women, you know, you had no rights to your kids if you were divorced. So there are a number of things. Women could not travel with their brother or their husband. A friend of ours had her son who was handicapped. You know, she couldn't take him, even she could afford to, outside for treatment, because her husband didn't want her to go out. So as a result of that, so all that, you know, all of a sudden, the restaurants were closed in Iraq because of Ramadan. So the 90s really were very horrible in that, not only from the social infrastructure, not from the introduction of Islam, but on top of that, the education of women suffered. You know, people could not afford to send their kids to school because they wanted their kids to work. So of course, and plus security was an issue. So all of a sudden, you have mothers who are extremely educated and their 14, 15-year-old daughter are even illiterate in certain areas, which today is a big issue in Iraq, because the majority of the Iraqi population is less than 25, and the majority of the Iraqi population is women, and these population are unfortunately not very well educated. So that is the status of Iraqi women today. Today the security issue is a big issue in Iraq. So as a result of that, women tend to get scared to go out. Women tend to get scared to, you know, if there are any work that requires you to stay late hours, women tend not to take that part of kind of a job, because how are you going to get back home? Their mobility is restricted because of the security issues. And before you were able to drive, I was able to walk. The way I am dressed in Iraq without anyone bothering me, today some women resort to the hijab or to the scarf, not because they want to, it's not because of a conviction or because of even a father restricting them to do that or a brother, but simply because for security, because you want to be part of the crowd and you don't want to stand out. So that is some shame. Actually, even some Christian people are covering themselves just so this way you don't get to stand out in the crowd. The political situation in Iraq today is very dodgy. We don't know, to be honest with you, where it's going to head. The constitution, there's a draft of the constitution. The draft of the constitution has mixed messages as far as human rights and women's rights are concerned. There is a way in the constitution, there's a place where kind of equal rights, you know, an Iraqi woman is an equal right. I can give Iraqi nationality to my child, even if my husband is not Iraqi, which is one of the few countries, if not the only country in the Middle East that actually allows you to do that. But at the same time, when it comes to personal status law, as far as a woman is concerned, there's another article within the constitution that says, well, you revert to the religious, whatever jurisdiction you're in and whatever religion you belong in, that can also take control over your, the right of a woman. So that kind of might create a chaos. We still don't know today. We're trying to push towards a federal state, you know, country. Is that okay? So with decentralization, what does that mean in regions like Karbala and Najaf and regions like the South, where you have a lot of influence you have a lot of influence of Iranian money today that's going on into the south of Iraq, and also in the what we call quote unquote the triangle, which is, you know, the Sunni triangle, and that's a lot of influence from people like Al Qaeda and other fundamentalist Muslims who are who don't want to Shia dominance in Iraq, and they're trying to pour their money in order to promote their own. I've heard horror stories where people in Fallujah men are forced to grow beards. Or women are forced to cover themselves the way Afghani women used to cover themselves, which is something unheard of in Iraq. We never used to have a woman covered from head to toe in black with all her face and everything. So these are the Sunni triangles being infiltrated by political agendas and monies to for the fundamentalists. And then from the Iranian side, we're having a lot of thing that's been there promoting the people like al-Sadr and other issues that really are kind of scary for the future of Iraqi women. As far as the U.S. and what the U.S. has tried, and they've done very well, at least in initially, is that they've guaranteed that we have at least 25% representation of women and the government in Iraq. So if you look at all the lists that political lists that were in the elections, every third name had to be a woman. Now, we have to caveat that. We want to make sure that we don't get token women as well. And we don't want to, personally, you know, it might be good, but personally, I would rather not have, it might be a good step, but the wave of what we call Islamist feminism, which is good, but it's not good for a secular person like me. You know, I'd like to still see a separation of government and religion, state and religion. But if Islamist feminism is an initial step that will help us get better things for women's rights in Iraq, then maybe we should also try to promote that. I still haven't made up my mind as far as whether that's a good thing or bad for Iraqi women. And so today there's a new government that's going to be formed in Iraq, and also we have a constitution that's going to be passed. Iraqi women are fighting for it. There are a lot of women who are endangering themselves inside Iraq. They're trying their best to make sure that they do, even the women that we have in the government that have been elected, to try and work towards women's rights, at least personal status law. So this way we don't lose our whatever rights we have so far. There is a danger that the Islamist feminism view the secular feminism. We don't want to have them fighting between each other. So what we're recommending is that they actually get together and try to talk to each other and find a commonality as a woman and see what are the issues that are important to women. Forget religion, you know, i.e., you know, I don't want to be beaten by my husband. If I get divorced tomorrow, I want to have the right to keep my kids. My husband can't come back getting angry and then just say divorce three times and that's it, I'm a divorced person to all of a sudden, which is the situation in a Sunni marriage, you know. So that's what women are trying to do. I know that there's a lot of leadership program training that the State Department is trying to do for Iraqi women. They're trying to bring them in here, teach them leadership issues, and teach them how to fight for your rights and how to mobilize? You know, how do you do grassroots movements? How do you educate your neighborhood? How do you work within your neighborhood and also within the political? Iraqis describe themselves as they were in prison for 30 years. They were in a large prison. So really, there's a lot. There are lots of things that they still need to do catching up on. Finally, in general, and that's general, whether it's you know, it's not just sort of in Iraq, but really in the whole region, there is a huge movement of fundamentalist Islam. Whether you look at the Egyptian, you know, there are a lot of people in Egypt. I just came back from Egypt for a visit in November, and I saw a lot of women hijab. You know, the same thing in Jordan, what we saw in Palestine with the Hamas. You know, in Lebanon, a lot of people are all of a sudden going back to, you know, just dressing up in a scarf, and I don't really know why, what's that movement. The thing we have to be careful about is that we're getting a new generation of men who are viewing fundamentalism as an accepted norm, and we really have to be careful with that. So when we're talking about educational programs, we have to talk about educational programs to the teenage boys as well. A lot of women in Iraq say, please don't just only train us, train our men. It's very important because I know what's right for me, but if you don't train my brother or my cousin who's controlling me, what is good for me, then the fight is, we still have a long way to fight. So the West has a lot to do. In the old days, we used to have a lot of good culture programs. You used to go to the British Council, you used to go to the Italian Council or the American Cultural Center in different countries in the region, and you would see very good programs. Programs that kind of bridge the gap. Today, people are getting exposed only to Hollywood, and Hollywood is very bad because it oftentimes conveys a very bad image of perception of the West, of Islam, which can backfire. So there are a lot that we can do individually, and there's a lot we can do as far as media training and reaching out to the new generation in the region. And if we don't do that early enough, my concern is that not really a third world, but a bigger cultural gap between the East and the West. Thank you.